This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thanks very much for coming and continuing the dialogue that we began this morning around questions of the social and poetry. So this is very much the second part to yesterday when we gave a reading together. And this is the first time that we've convened as a group, and in no sense do we represent a unified, I think, this can be debated, but there's no consensus here, but there's a shared set of commonalities, I think, that we noticed anyway when we listened to each other read yesterday evening. And perhaps we can discuss some what those are at the formal level and also in terms of the way that the form argues itself through its reception among ourselves and those else who are present. So we've discussed how to present the public face of our meeting and decided that we would leave it somewhat open. Spent the morning, as I said, working through various issues that we thought our poetry raised, and that we thought the word social as an adjective placed before poetry raised. But we attempted, I think, as often as possible to make it specific rather than obvious, which is very much perhaps how the word social is received today. It seems the most perhaps banal thing to say about poetry, and of course it's not true. It's marked in very specific ways by context, by address, etc. And so we were exploring some of those issues together, coming from different locales as we do. So I'm just introducing the panelists and opening it up, I suppose, to anyone here who'd like to begin to perhaps reiterate some of the rhetorical movements that we very balletically perform this morning, or otherwise. Let me just start then. Pardon me, allowing for a pause. And I just want to read, and this is not being scripted, but let me just read an example of how I'll just read a quote from Marx's Capital, which is perhaps, to me, exemplary of how Marx conceived of the social as a concept. As the taste of the porridge does not tell you who grew the oats, no more does this simple process, commodity exchange, tell you of itself what are the social conditions under which it is taking place. Whether under the slave owner's brutal lash or the anxious eye of the capitalist, whether Cincinnatus carries it on in tilling his modest farm, or a savage in killing wild animals with stones. So, I mean, I suppose that's a sort of the historical example of how Marx conceived the social. It's a concept. It's a negative concept because it evokes a suppressed knowledge of social relations that need to be perceived, need to be articulated.
Would you mind reading how we're done?
Sure.
Por favor.
Sure. So from Volume 1 of Capital, as the taste of the porridge does not tell you who grew the oats, no more does this simple process, and by process here he means commodity exchange or exchange value, tell you of itself what are the social conditions under which it is taking place. whether under the slave owner's brutal lash or the anxious eye of the capitalist, whether Cincinnatus carries it on in tilling his modest farm, or a savage in killing wild animals with stones. So it's a negative concept in the sense that it's attempting to articulate a suppressed set of social relations and the sort of the consciousness, the knowledge that would come with those relations were they made perceptible.
Well, I have a question. Just about suppressed, but I thought you said repressed the first time. And it struck me that that's a really pervasive metaphor for a lot of poetics. It's not exactly Freudian, but that it is by avoiding cliched rationality, it has a better chance of opening up repressed knowledge of the social. And I just wonder about that, actually. It seems to me that there, now maybe I'm pinning it to what you actually say, but this doesn't seem like a pressing problem, forget it now. But perhaps it isn't a question so much of suppressed, redressed knowledge needing to be something, a barrier needing to be broken over to get to that knowledge. But it has to be, routes of mediation have to be constructed. It's really more of a question of the density of the mediations that are overwhelming. So I'm just proposing, I guess, I'm suggesting a very different model of what needs to be done these days.
Let me just jump in and say that, there was no consensus on me reading this quote from Marx, and I don't want to throw us off from the way that we've been talking about. No, there's no agenda.
That's why.
It's not as if we're talking about repressed or suppressed. Or knowledge is the only way of conceiving the social. But this is sort of like, I would say, just the exemplary case of how historically this word is being used. But that was 150 odd years ago. So.
Since things are never truer than today, my friend.
Well, related to Marx in terms of density, it's one of the terms that's been bandied about a lot that we haven't come to a consensus on or even come to a thorough description of is the notion of scale and a kind of poetics of scale in relation to the question of the social and how the scale could be applied to a wide range of phenomena. I mean, the tension inherent in the term social is its generality, its blanket, uses a blanket term, and then, far into the other end of the spectrum would be very specific, concrete social practices in which the social manifests itself. So these are kind of poles that we've been kind of balancing back and forth against, and an idea of scale that maybe Jeff can talk to, since he was the one who kind of introduced the term, as one way of navigating these poles, navigating these densities, navigating these mediations,
and maybe in the present tense, rather than as like a summation of what we've already talked about, how might we continue that discussion of the question of scale in relation to
Scale also works because the kind of a more even obvious current, I quite call it dialectic, but thinking about contemporary culture and politics, of course, is the local and the global. And so scale, comes out of that particular model, but I think as we're trying to figure out a way of making it applicable to a wider range of phenomena as opposed to just the local global.
The scale debate, some critical geography
we're an attack against the global local, in the sense that that doesn't supply a complex enough set, or even not to say complex, because I know you said complex, and complex, making things complex tends to hide things, but just a more usable set of scales, in a sense. So global local gets challenged as the privileged articulation of scale within this debate. And one of the key essays is by a guy called Eric Swinburne. It's called something like "There Is No Global Local," something like a direct challenge. No, beyond the global local. So it's like the kind of classics move within the scale debate is to start from the body, go to the like body, neighborhood, urban, regional, national, and then usually jumping up to the global after that. So it has and then when I was teaching in Minnesota, we were talking about globalization, about how culture might function, every time a scale came up, I wrote it on the board. So immediately we ended up with global local. And then when people were thinking of ways how to intervene, or where the effects of globalization materialized, then I would add it to the board. So we ended up like going from the body. We interjected a couple extra in there. We had the international or the transnational, and we had one other subnational grouping. But the idea of the scale debates is merely to provide a set of spatialize social struggle and social process so that you can imagine spaces where these struggles take place and how to intervene. And then one kind of very nice bumper sticker-like slogan that I like from the debate is that a re-spatialization is a re-politicization. So what we did in the class that I was teaching and in other seminars I've been sitting in on is think of ways of how there's been re-spatializations, particularly within the U.S. through neoliberalism. So for instance, there'd be like a re-spatialization from the national level down to the urban level and some things like around social housing. It's been scaled back from the national to the city. And then sometimes the city bails out, and then ultimately you can say that it goes to a neighborhood region, and then it ends up but always materializing at the level of the body. So the same with, you could say that in Canada, the struggle over universal Medicare is one that's going to be scaled down from the national if the neoliberals has been out, and it's going to be ultimately scaled down to the individual. So there's those kinds of shifts. But then there's also shifts where you can see opposition arising within other articulations of scale. And that's called scale jumping, where like where you jump over one scale where it will seemingly be ineffective to organize in order to articulate two scales within a struggle. So
you're scale jumping in your work, I think, in terms of the type of address in your, let's say, the work that you read last night.
I consciously try to do some scale jumping, but also try and do it, all of us were talking about registers of language, or what we could call discourses as well. So I try to do it in differently situated discourses, which I think also Laura's work does really effectively. So for me, it's been a move away from a more of a temporal model to a spatial one. This is a way of trying to locate sites of where culture takes place and where opposition can take place. And the kind of space of hope that I feel the most for at the moment is the urban level. I'll just give an example of what I feel is turning out to be an effective site for organizing is, you know, there's all these cities now in the U.S. who passed ordinances, first of all against the war, but then also against the Patriot Act. So there's these cities where the city government has passed a city law that says that the city police cannot do the kinds of arrests that the Patriot Act calls for them to do because it goes against the human rights at their city level. So that's a pretty interesting scale jump in order to initiate politics.
But also a symptom of how, you know, universal human rights in the UN Declaration of 1948 have themselves been reduced down to the level of sort of like community activism.
I normally say that you would fight back in a sense of that at the national level, but what happens in this, with the current regime here is that it's ineffective to try and intervene nationally, so it's been scaled down to this other level.
And Bob, so to address your question about whether or not information is repressed, I think that in the tremendous gap between the local global scales, I think that information does get repressed because we're bombarded with nonsense in the mainstream news channels because they're very cheap to produce, like the human interest stories and, you know, stuff that Microsoft puts on its news site that's all sales and advertising. And so I think that in order to resist that repression of information, because in effect I think that that's what happens, well, density isn't going away, unfortunately, so I think that things only can become more dense. So, like, we have to, I think, locate the pores in which we might intervene, as Jeff's talking about, and discriminate between different gradations of scale and populate that information with things that are getting completely lost, even though they do exist in sometimes very obscure sources. In the poem series that I most recently written, that I read from last night, that was a case of an event completely getting demolished. Like, the sources I had to go to find for information was literally the Los Angeles Lay Catholic Mission. Like, I was going to religious organizations to find, like, some shred of something on the record that this takeover of the county and sheriff's department had occurred. And so, in that case, it was literally almost not present at all, to where I was trying to contact individual people for information. But even when it is out there and there's a lot of information that does exist, it just gets snowballed by, you know, our mass media organization. So if we can resist that with smaller voices and understand that, you know, we might not have like one huge visible resistance movement, but many small ones that can...
That segues sort of into another one of the sort of problematics or things that we noticed about a lot of our poetry last night and that we started to talk a little bit about this morning, and very much fits in with what you said about density and finding mediating articulatory ways of bringing those to some kind of conscious. Is the idea of the fragment. And so clearly last night, all of us in one way or another were using either fragmented language, single sentences. But something that is different maybe about this than like a disjunctive poetic is that instead of like in a sort of modernist way, focusing on the fragment as a fragment, treating that as a sort of general social logic that once you're aware of, then what do you do? Well, you start to articulate these into some totality or whole. some you know, what now? If this is a generalized sort of condition for information and language use.
Yeah, fragmentation is a given in a way that it might not even have been 10 years ago, 20 years ago. So to buy into fragmentation, at this point, there's a certain complicity, I think, that goes on.
There's a
certain complicity that goes on, I think, and there's an
complicity.
A need to rethink the approach to fragmentation, I think, is something that you know, a lot of people are doing, not just, you know, poets, writers in this room, but a lot of people out there are kind of rethinking that idea and you know, we take fragmentation as a given where we go next.
But in some ways, just to extend what you were saying, yeah, that That's assuming that the natural, let's say, given the obvious way to, let's say, write a poem would be to present the fragment. I wonder if that's the case. You know, for example, when I listened to everyone's work last night, obviously the fragment rarely, if ever, fetishized, let's say, presented. I've heard whole sentences, I've heard, a fusing of sentences that were nevertheless some clear phrasal level or whatever, but I rarely sort of heard the schizoid fragment just sort of floating in the air. So in other words, was it that and in your work, this extraordinary sort of narrative sense of clarity, right, in your poems. So is it then that there was a decision not to go the obvious route of the fragment and instead to privilege narrative, conjunctive relations in the text? Or is it that that it's not that the fragment is obvious and something that we're critiquing, but that it's simply the premise is rather that it has something to do with narrative itself?
Yeah, I'm speaking more of the fragment and the larger cultural condition. I'm not. I think probably within very specific lineages of contemporary poetry, the fragment may be taken as a given, or maybe not. I'm thinking more just the fragmentation of the larger culture, the way we receive information.
The lack of scale that Jeff was...
The lack of scale, or, the kind of bombardment that Carol was talking about to the point of nonsense, for which, it's nonsensical because it's coming in completely decontextualized fragments. So, there's a need at some level to start synthesizing and making critical decisions within that information. That's kind of what I'm trying to do in my own work. I'm not so sure it's a narrative, but it's certainly an attempt to synthesize, read through information and take bits of it and put it together, probably more junctively than disjunctively. But nevertheless, I think it's more in a larger cultural condition, which, we shouldn't generalize to even the entire world or even the entire U.S. population, because postmodernism, as we now know, is ultimately a pretty local phenomenon. But I'm kind of more speaking to that. It's a given in the culture. It's not so much, AWP is happening 100 miles from here. It's not a given there, that's for sure.
One way, though, I'm sorry, Jeff.
Well, I just want to connect something that Louis said earlier, is that how form is being generated through an attention to the social rather than sort of attention to the sort of poetic lineage per se. When I think of Mark Nowak's poetry in that way, I don't see the relationship he has to the social as sort of the model to pick up for everyone. I mean, I think it works in some cases, but I like how he is receiving trying to attach form to a sort of some kind of reception from the social. But I think that's happening in my work too, where I'm really interested in what forms keep getting repeated in social institutions. Why do certain paradoxes keep getting reformulated, or certain maybe boxes or hermetic ways are getting always reconstructed in any social sphere? And I want to figure out, how does that get? Why is it first of all repeated? But where are they coming from? Who's involved? What are the psychologies that are being reproduced in that sense? And so that's where I feel like I'm getting my poems when I think about poetry.
The way that I was understanding fragmentation was not just a sort of syntactical, break. Say, like if you say complete, various, adjust his regard to, just words off the page that would sound sort of disjunctive in terms of syntax. I think that's what you're referring to in terms of the fragment. There's also another way to look at the fragment in terms of the very lexicon in which you use, right? It could be contained within a fairly regular sentence, but the lexicon is so heterogeneous that you say it's a fragment because it's a discursive angle. There's these discursive sort of grabs at the sentence that make it heterogeneous. And what we were talking about earlier was that one of the reasons why this is happening, or why one of the ways to explain this is the uneven, what we're calling an uneven cultural terrain, and then that being caused by uneven development. So it went like this. Capitalism is uneven development. It produces an uneven cultural terrain, and so how do we detect that in the poetry through the through lexical selections, and how do we act on it? Do we treat that uneven cultural terrain as something natural and given, or do we treat it as a symptom of uneven development, and how do we intervene on that level in a sort of reflexive way too, and in motion as we're doing it?
And you're intervening, because of your work, you're intervening it on multiple levels of address to different notions of who you are addressing your poem to, audience. Would that be the case?
Yeah,
lexical selection and otherwise. For example, Jules is doing the same thing, right? When you there's a declared sentence of the proper name, noun, Joan Retallack in it.
We're talking about
it's a selective address to a particular poetic constituency, as much as to an individual. But it's a way of calling out to it's a type of shout out to one's own anticipated reception, right? So it's almost like the argument of the form is worked out through sort of a self-reflexive attention to how one's work might be received and by whom.
Right, and the last part is the key. Speaking for myself, and I imagine other people too, I mean, that self-reflexive element. And I find it explicit in Rodrigo's work. There are enormous gaps in my education. There are enormous gaps in our education, you know.
Like yours.
Yours, sorry. so, you know, I mean, very acknowledging at a literal level that our own complicity in this. So I, when I hear the shout-out term, I get a little nervous, you know, because I feel like it's sort of static. Whereas, as you describe the shout-out term, I feel a lot better about it, because it points to the sort of dynamism involved in it, and the complicity and everything, too. So.
You kind of also ended before we started up again, though. So if we're in the process, then therefore now, where we did a scale jump of the micro aesthetic in a way to the macro ideological, or decided somehow just through the process of talking that there's a kind of a cultural logic to the fragment that's that through the reading last night, we saw an emergent cultural logic of the fragment that didn't privilege the fragment as containing the whole, but rather how to articulate fragments into some sort of model that addresses the whole. I had, like, as my joke, like the inner Stalin thing that kind of blows up at that point, and I wanted to, like, kind of force some totality. Alan had to balk at the word totality, and that's, like, more kind of look back a little bit. So we can have, like, running jokes around the totality, but I think I felt that we were kind of hopefully aiming towards, you know, the poem as an articulating device that can construct a kind of social logic based on articulation that can be thought of as a social logic for organizing. So not the kind of fear of a totality in a sense, or not the kind of fear of an articulated structure, but it always has to be a dispersed network, or rather one where connections are made, and out of that. So, where spatial connections are made, and then lexical, discursive, different political positions, different particularities, different struggles are linked. So I saw, and then others as well saw through the course of the discussion, some kind of cultural logic emerging. I'll address sort of what Lily's concern too of the level of form in poetry.
I'm suddenly just again reacting to a phrase. The fear of totality, and it just strikes me that, you know, who's afraid of the big bad wolf? I mean, what hideous totalities in poetry, you know, are oppressing us, or the shadows of possibilities of any hint of one millionth of an approach to any kind of totality. I mean, it's a sort of bogey word, totality. I mean, nobody wants to, get thee behind me totality. And
it's been used pretty favorably.
What's the big worry? I mean, first of all, what access to totality do any of us imagine that we have?
But I don't think you're disagreeing. I think actually Jeff is saying that it's not a fear, but it's a desire to address.
Global fear of panopticality, there's a lot.
I don't think that
I don't not get fear. Fear. Okay, can take a better word, but this distaste, distrust of us.
We want the totality in some way.
I don't want totality.
Is that a group? You totally agree all
No, I don't.
Well, we just started speaking this morning, so
we have no group. Shared mindframe. I don't think Jeff's talking about poetic totality.
No, I'm not.
We're still vaguely trying to even figure out what the phrase social mark means and what's the phrase social means. So less in terms of whether there are poetic totalities or whether we have access to that. It's just more a question of how can you define the word social? And there's a sense that possibly you could create an awareness that encompassed the social totality. And correct or no? I mean, and I'm instantly skeptical. No, more than skeptical, resistant to that idea, because as soon as you take the word social for granted in any form, which you have to do when you create a totality, you have created sets of exclusions and inclusions, and a whole range of problems that aren't worth going into.
Evoke, not spelled out as in a manifesto. Programmatic manifesto of this is what the totality is, but to try and evoke it through
why even evoke it?
Well,
tie back to the way you're talking about the fragment.
Well, there's the sense that we experience capitalism in a total fashion, even if it's fragmented. So maybe I'm saying this wrong, but if to try to form some kind of dissident practice, especially in culture and poetry, we would definitely want to imagine some kind of counter totality, not the Stalinism that control of every. Facet of culture, not like that at all, but what would it mean to be able to articulate a real dissident practice that takes into account culture and economy and the political and the social and how they're interrelated and how some of them get elided by combinations of others. I mean.
Well, my epistemology might be not great, but I think I experience capitalism in a very different way than other people experience capitalism, and to abstract capitalism from other questions of gender and ethnicity and geography.
No.
I don't know how you can create a totality. I don't even know how you can evoke a totality.
Yeah.
But with those differential sets of experiences and knowledges and...
Isn't it more...
That's my resistance to the word. It's not in any way resistance to... Like the desire to create.
So it's it's a false word then. I mean, there's something profoundly false about convening a panel like this
I only wish Alan that the WTO agreed with you, because they certainly enforce capitalism as a totality.
Yes, I mean capitalism is a finite system with a lot of possibilities, It doesn't have to, reach in this way or that way, according to what opposes it. But the way that I look at the word totality is just a sort of acknowledgement of the finite limits of capital in a given instance. And so the poetry you know, can refer to that, of course, being part and parcel of a dynamic development toward capital's, you know, totality in a resistant form. That any sense, but unless you're talking about totality as a sort of like just an epistemological perspective. I mean,
well, I think though it's also, yeah, I don't know, I think that totality, I think that we might all agree that we probably have some basic shared goals, everybody in this room, like increased parity of economic distribution and power distribution. And in that sense, you know, totality can be a useful sort of loose concept. But I think that in our methods for whatever kind of cultural advances or marks that we might make, totality is something that we want to steer clear of, because with the power disparities being what they are, I think that it's going to be our smaller channels, our grassroots efforts that we're going to need to continue to pursue, because they've been the channels by which we've achieved every success that we've experienced recently. So I think in that sense, like, totality might be dangerous. I don't know that we necessarily need to project that we'll have one collective, but you know,
I think I was simply saying that with the fragment, the idea of a poetics built on a fragment, that whatever our interest was in showing how these fragmented existences, social living structures, and you know, in one person, in one you know, through many different spaces, like not to build any kind of poetic practice that you know, raises the fragment to some level of like a desirability in and of itself, as if it's the fragment that's going to save us. Vice versa, it's not the totality of fragmentation either. So, I mean, I just wanted to say that I wasn't speaking of, when I brought up the thing of the fragment and the totality as a way of understanding, like, a culture or the, you know, huge, you know, an infinite array of social practices, really. I mean, maybe it's not, I wouldn't say it's infinite, but nonetheless, I agree with you, in other words. I just wanted to clarify what I meant by that.
Yeah.
Can I ask Helen a question for you? Because I was thinking, actually, just in my vocabulary, I was thinking, first of all, Marcel Mauss, who says there's this total social phenomenon and involves sort of the ways the body operates, from sleeping, walking, to economic, political, social mores and stuff like that. But your poetry specifically, I'm thinking, like, how do you navigate, like, a lot of it is sort of like, I go this way, but then I got sidetracked this way, and then it's sort of the cow, is that this model of, I don't know, this huge statue I saw, or was it this other thing? I mean, so when you're sort of walking through your own poetic sort of navigation system, how do you, I mean, if it's not a totality in some way, where do you stop and where do you go in some way? How do you navigate yourself like that?
That's a difficult question. I mean, I think, you know, it would be hard to reduce it to one thing. I mean, I think that, you know, everyone in this room would, you know, probably have a similar type of response. I mean, I may be stopped as much in the poem by a desire to work with a certain kind of sound at a moment. I mean, it's not that the you know, I can reach some critical enlightenment or impasse, and now it's time to take a turn. It could be that simply at a certain line, I want to have a, you know, end rhyme or an internal rhyme, so I'll switch it for that reason. I mean, I wouldn't want to say that there's any reason that it's navigated according to some grand plan or anything like that. I mean, it could be, you know, a need to like anybody in this room probably, you know, maybe a need to interject a moment of kind of popular culture, or, you know, interject some reference to something that actually works against things that have come before, or, you know what I mean? I just, it's kind of play as you go in some way. But I'm interested in the way in which individual agents process information. The kind of decentering of subjectivity is just kind of not where I'm working right now. as you know, critical political agents in the world, it's our responsibility to get information and process it.
Can you put the risk of inflaming the air? Can you give an example of a decent of a poetry that this is always a taboo, you know, this kind of question I'm going to ask in any public gathering. But I mean, I'm interested in a constructive way in exploring, not as Jeff said, you know, you said, you know, we are trained to notice differences, which prevents us from considering the commonalities and workings in a parallel manner. But given that, let's say, and I think you especially, Alan, are really adept at noticing the subtleties and particularities of any style of poetry, of many styles of poetry. And so can you give an example of let's say, a decentered, I forget your phrase, poetry that is
subjective.
A decentered, that has a decentered subjectivity that's written, that's being written today? Can anyone? Or
radically decentered subjectivity? I don't know, maybe some of the more extreme formal experiments of some people in Toronto, or...
Like, yeah.
I mean, what I mean to say is I think it's something, and I don't think it's exclusive to poetry. It's clearly an inheritance of, you know, critical discourse of the past 20 plus years. It's, you know, it's as much a legacy of 70s conceptual art as it is of various forms of poetry. I'm not in any way singling any particular tradition out. I get the sense that there's been reconsideration of that. On all levels, in the art world, in the poetry world, in the world of academic theory or critical theory, there's been a slight adjustment. I mean, what was the critical buzzword in the 90s? Agency. Certainly, that was some kind of response to 70s and 80s decentered. What's that?
Textuality and then agency.
And then agency, right. Well, textuality was part of that process. I can't point to current practice.
Well, it's inside and outside the poem. I mean, there's poetry neophyte, you know, Bruce Andrews' work with decentered subjectivity, but yeah. as a working poet, Bruce's subjectivity is quite, his practice is quite organized. It's not decentered. Bruce sometimes writes vacation brochures and sometimes writes, you know, other.
Yeah.
So, you know, the announced and the enunciation of the announced issue inside and outside.
Yeah. I guess Bruce would be someone who kind of just continues doing that.
So I'm wondering, I'm listening to everybody speak, and Mark, I'm thinking about your poetry, which is very local, probably the most locally based of anyone among us, perhaps. And I'm kind of wondering about scalability, and I wonder if some qualities that we might value in any cultural production in our current political climate is something that's, first of all, scalable, and we can talk about what that might mean. But I think that one of the qualities might be that it's forced while being specific, and here I'm thinking of Rodrigo, your lexicon. And having a lexicon that's specific and that is both forward-looking and historical-looking, but is also but also allows for further integration. It's not finite, so that's your folklore. And I wonder if that might be something that's important to us going forward. And thinking about your poetry, Mark, I'm thinking about the Zapatistas and looking at that community as one in which it is obviously and effectively working democracy, but I believe it's also a scalable model. You can have many Zapatista communities, and then as they integrate, sort of understand what those rules are going to be as they come together. And so perhaps you can understand the gradations of cultural agency in that sense. But it's a funny balance, like, as I think of how can you be specific and porous, but it makes sense to me. I don't know if it makes sense to other people.
let me just switch. Sorry. Mark, there's no one.
Can he answer?
Address. No,
Can I ask a follow-up? One of the critiques of the spatialization model is that it's too urban-based. And I'm wondering if you wanted to address that critique, and I'm asking this follow-up now for two reasons. One, because the Zapatista, because Carol's introduced the Zapatistas, which I think for many of us has served as a model and an inspiration in a lot of ways. And also in terms of Kaya, this is something we didn't really bring up earlier, but you know, when we were thinking about these questions of scale, and you were saying it starts with the body and immediately goes to the neighborhood, et cetera, et cetera. One thing that has dropped out, and I'm no ecologist or environmentalist, but you know, I really want to make sure that the bioregional is inserted into that scale, and it hasn't been yet. I don't know, Kaya, you know, the poem that you wrote, Aquifer. I'm sorry, yeah, Aquifer. You know, and the research you did in the river systems for that, and you know, if we can just. It doesn't have to be addressed right now, but I want to just toss out bioregionalism as a necessary component at scale. The critique of spatialization is urban-based, and then and coming out of that critique, the understanding that for a vast majority of the world's population still functions in an agricultural, in large part, subsistence mode, and that one of the amazing things about the jealous uprising is that, you know, it happens at the root of the formation of capitalism because it's primitive accumulation that ultimately the Zapatistas are resisting. It's a certain, basically it's expropriation from the land. And, you know, we all know from Marx at least, that's the roots of capitalism, the expropriation of peasants from the land. So this may be way too big and unwieldy, but I'm just kind of curious if we can talk a little bit about questions of scale, spatialization, just in kind of relation to those issues, or we can just put it on the back burner for later, but before we move in a different direction.
I think there's a quick, maybe three quick answers. And that is that I think what's very useful in the spatial scale debate is to think scale as a process. That scale is not a set of locked-in zones that then you can like plug into, but rather that it's a process within capital where scales are continually merging and also continually redefined in a way. So for instance, a bioregional is not a scale we would have thought of before, but it doesn't mean that the model can't hold it.
No, I'm sure.
So I mean, that's what I like about it, is a kind of flexibility to it that can allow that to happen. And as far as the critique of the urban, the spatial scale argument holds, has privileged the urban as a site. I think that's partially because there's been a condensation of effects at the urban level. So the urban level has become the privileged site because it's more concentrated. But also that under globalization, there's also been a process of urbanization, and the movement from the rural to the urban is seen as a process of globalization, not merely a dialectic between the urban and the rural. But also, I think that you invoked Marx. I think that actually, if you take the scale argument back to Marx, and we can think that how the regional is actually defined by the technological innovations in transportation, particularly in the bioregional. That's a huge region now because of new methods of transportation. So the bioregion for a tomato is immense now, whereas before it was very small. Particularly that most
bioregion of a tomato?
Yeah. I mean, literally how far you could take it.
And diseases, too. They come from all over.
So this is like a really interesting example of how the tomato example, which I
Well, I have I was thinking about that and with the tomato example too, is even the fact that what the genes of flounder are put into the tomato, so that actually came up for me in a poem where I can make that juxtaposition that maybe I couldn't make somewhere else. And that I'll just pick up the thread that you proposed in terms of ecology. Marcella Durand has done some really interesting writing on this on ecopoetics. And that's the way in which, for me, like writing aquifer in terms of scale too, I could do things in poetry, make connections globally, you know, make connections in terms of a tempering scale that I couldn't do anywhere else. And I think that Marcella Durand articulated this in terms of the fact that when ecology is written about in social sciences or in journalism, the constraints actually in some ways keep us from really understanding ecology, understanding the interconnectedness of ecology that's possible through juxtapositions, you know, in poetry. So I found it pretty amazing to start to explore ecology because I could bring in issues of class, for instance, you know, that just through these juxtapositions, so that, you know, Coca-Cola and this woman, you know, they could all be next to each other.
Well, this also helps with speed too. There's a very popular method in software development called extreme programming that became very popular in the mid-90s, and its whole focus is scalability. And it was all developed because some, you know, leading technicians knew that the web was just going to blow out of the water, and if any of our applications were going to sustain, they were going to have to develop a methodology where things could be recoded part and parcel, in a scalable manner, so that you wouldn't have to throw away all of your old work as it became obsolete, but build it in a more modular sense. And so, culturally, Jeff, before you brought this thinking to the table, I wasn't aware that discussions about scalability were happening about our culture. But in terms of becoming ecologically active, culturally active, it also, I think, arms us with some pretty powerful tools and methods of resistance.
I'm really interested in your terms, helping forest and specific. I think those are extremely interesting. And they're, you could say in a very abstract way, they're desirable. But in fact, there's a tremendous antagonism there in terms of poetics and the various social issues of social communication. That the specific is what's coded in a small social group, say, that which is porous, I'm just thinking of what's on the line with the ecology of the stranger. Porous, the porosity of societies it's not a given that that's something progressive. In fact, there's tremendous backlashes, ethnic cleansing, etc., that the sensitivity to porosity and the way it registers for many people as something incredibly toxic. Is an absolute problem that any of our poetry has to face. And the specific is very comfortable. I recognize this. I can understand what this guy's saying. I can understand the accent. You know, there's no funny words there. The clothes, the haircut, the whole thing, the posture. I agree that there's something, there's a really interesting, that those two things go together very interestingly, but there's a tremendous antagonism on the surface to the two things, and to deal with, to manage some sort of porosity, to manage to construct some of it in a visible way, I think it's a real challenge.
I totally agree. Maybe what I should do is clarify the crisis that I'm addressing and imagining, like, is porous, something that I value and thinking that it is. It's obviously integration, but even specifically, the root crisis is how can we imagine communities that that are truly open to integration for people with different class backgrounds, different national backgrounds. We were talking about nationalism earlier. And so to base your community model on something that is open, if not necessarily diverse, because realistically speaking, few communities are truly diverse. But as a model, I think we at least have to start with them being accessible.
Which is actually setting the bar extremely high.
So why not?
Yeah, no, but the words sound very innocent, but it's a really hard problem.
Well, I think we sort of talked about this, maybe not using these words, but I think it's interesting that it's come up again in this way. We sort of talked a little bit early on about the idea of social code, and specifically as regards poetry, Rodrigo, you were saying this idea of writing with, well, let's see, you use the term combined struggle, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe I don't understand, maybe you could talk, you know, specifically what you mean by that, but one of my impressions is that something that you do a lot in your poetry is to, and that Mark is interested in doing, is trying to bridge audiences. Like, so Mark, you said, you know, I'm interested in creating something that one, can be read in an atmosphere like this, which is a gallery, and two, that can be read somewhere else, like a union hall. And on the one hand, complicate representational methods in the union hall, in other words, complicate what people, the audience there is going to understand as, I'm losing my words, as porous, whereas doing maybe the reverse. How do you code that in the poem? And I mean, I guess that's where we started talking about the shout out as being, I don't know, you would say lexicon, I think, right?
Well, it's just a matter of, you know, detection. How would you be able to detect, like that you're speaking to a different audience if you're talking about the text that you're reading? How would you know? Like, one of the poems I read last night, you know, for example, there was the thing about the loofah sponge. I said loofah. Well, you know, I mean, you say loofah, who would know what that is? And so I said, you don't belong, you know, I personify and even develop. And on the other hand, I used another word, gaffled, which means, in on the East Coast or at least in New York, you know, gaffled is like a drug deal that's gone wrong. I give you money, you don't give me an exchange, but it's also a way of describing an exchange that, you know, that didn't happen. It's very specific. And so that would sort of, you know, I'm interested in sharpening those contradictions so that they're as sharp as they can be in a reading, so that like an audience, so all the divisions, you know, that I think are coming from uneven development or the effect of uneven development are felt, and then kind of jettison those and infuse those with the politics, which I would, you know, support as being social emancipatory type of politics and things like that. But I can't just do it by just saying, you know, being triumphalist about it and saying, well, here's the, you know, the socialist horizon, blah, blah, let's just all go over there without sort of trying to reach as concretely as I can.
Through disparate audiences. Yes. It's like you've got a classroom, mixed classroom.
There you go.
You know, you have to teach two lesson plans in the same 20 minutes, and they're not a happy, classroom audience.
That's tricky, right?
Yeah, that's what the whole, I think the dramatic challenge is how to speak that, and how to, you know, like in poetry, for example, how not to let go of certain struggles that are going on culturally, like knowing your antecedents, knowing some of the things, how loaded those things are, some of those propositions, whatever comes to poetic, not letting, at the same time, being able to speak to an audience who concretely can connect with sort of representations of mediated life structures, et cetera, like that. And you know, and combine the two and keep them going and be honest about it. Not like speaking to a, you know, like a union hall audience and pretend that there's not a struggle, you know, in literature going on over these things. Also, you know, cross-educate those people and say, look, this is just culture is struggled over generally, not just, you know, it's not transparent in that way.
It's very interesting, Bob, that you immediately thought of a pedagogical setting, because, you know, uneven development comes from Marx's spatial geographers. But also, it seems like the way that you're using the term here to refer to how you evoke different social registers in your poetry is very much uneven development in the sense of different levels of education, different levels of pedagogical
engagement. No, I would say, like, if you don't know what gaffled, for example,
exactly.
Is a concrete example.
So that's not going to be porous.
That's an education. I wouldn't put that outside of a pedagogical moment, you know? Why would you put like loofah? Why, you know, you're presenting as an educational.
No, what I'm saying is it's uneven cultural self-consciousness, knowledge, ability to engage. And what you're trying to do is what you're saying is that this text, this poetic text, is engages on multiple levels with multiple audiences and expectations. And it's not also like flat, two-dimensional, uniformly porous to everyone. There's no presumption that everyone will get it. There's a sense that you will enter at this point, and then someone else over there will enter at another point.
That's right.
Someone will get the loofah, someone else will get gavels. The person who gets gavels might not know what the hell a loofah is.
At the same time, we're not presenting myself as some sort of arbiter that's outside of this very motion as a socially unevenly constructed subject of sorts. At the same time, thrown in too, is a triadic sort of dialectic.
So it's an interesting, to think of it just using the word pedagogical instead of uneven development, it's an interesting way to think of different ways of reading the text. Some parts are going to be more transparent than other parts, and there's many to different people, and there's many different examples of poets who do that. Some of us around this room and other contemporaries who, I'm thinking of, let's say, someone else. But what I want to get to is in your particular case, it's the social inflection or the social mark in your case is, let's say, it's constructive, or to use Jeff's word, it's conjunctive. You know, let's say, for example, let's use a text like Bruce Andrews' Shut Up, let's say, where the most explicit, porous statements are sort of on the level of invective, right? And very aggressive kind of address to the audience. Whereas in your case, it's like when you invoke these different ears, listening ears,
there's also running out of
it's to bring them in and take them somewhere. It's a kind of a constructive conjunctive production.
And also there's like sound. I know we're not about to go into sound, but there's also those moments where you don't know where this lays, and that's why I use sound sometimes or nonsensical language, sort of patched in to sort of represent that sort of grazing up again when I feel something is grazing up against that doesn't have a language. So I would also say it's a sort of like a thing that's about to happen, a sort of interface that's about to happen. You can represent that too dramatically, or that just happened and it wasn't engaged or interfaced.
Well, maybe David, you could talk to this because I think there's a number of examples of how the Zao, the transrational or the moment of this inarticulate sound, or the stutter or Rodrigo's, that sort of like achieving sort of like a sound in a poem is nevertheless situated within a sort of like a social matrix of concerns, right? Inflected through the kind of lexicon of social struggle, etc. Inflected by sort of meta-level sort of statements that are in your poem, So it's not, for example, let's think of a completely different scenario where, let's say, your model for the treatment of sort of Zaum effects, right, transrational sound effects, is, let's say, Zara around the time of World War I. But you're doing it, let's say, in the 1990s, and you decide to become sort of like a virtuoso of the sound performance. And there's no sort of, let's say, there's no sort of social matrix of concerns sort of like that are embedded within that use of sound in your work. I mean, in contrast to that, there are examples here, for example, with sound works in your work or in David's work, where it's situated, socially situated within a set of marked, socially marked valencies, words, connotations.
And it's gendered. The articulation of that is gendered. Yeah, I really don't. Transrational.
Well, when you go, that's kind of
well, it's
beyond.
I think it's already been present just in the discussion. I think what interests me most about what we're all struggling with is the these collective articulations of crises and the stutter, which is not just a vocal performative, but you think of various uses of fragmentation, paratoxins, etc., as a kind of stuttering in the process of articulation and relational poetics. And that's one, in fact, I think fairly banal in some ways, way of presencing that those crises and the sort of overdetermined contradictions at work in the writings in the text, right? And I can almost go so far as to say it's more interesting in my experience of the contemporary moment. It's more interesting that we don't start with nothing but stuttering and to achieve words, or what we conventionally think of as poetry, would be sort of the odd thing that needs to be explained, right? But again, I'm more interested in sort of thinking in terms of reading strategy, interpretation strategies, as both readers and writers sort of simultaneously, as sort of these crises manifesting themselves in language work. However, I'm not interested in the category of poetry so much, but we'll call it understanding in this context is the poetics. And that there are not, I think we're in a moment of transition, which is the Gramsci quote that Jules was working through last night, with this interregnum where we have morbid symptoms that are appearing while certain political, economic, cultural, and social formations are always in transition, but are particularly in a moment of intense or determined contradictory transition, not only in the sense of globalizations and the plurality of those different formations, but in terms of cultural workers and activists and quote-unquote avant-gardists attempting to find ways to articulate that and to and disarticulate, re-articulate, and work through those things when it's no longer it's no longer that classic Marxian problematic of sort of if we can just sort of pierce the veil and then we'll see the truth of, or if we were in modernist literary tradition within the Euro-American ambit of just reveal the device and the truth of ideology within. Because I think the idea of the fragment is that's sort of supposed base or something itself is already a fragment. It's already in the sort of totalized scare quotes. And for me, it's sort of fine. That's just part and parcel of the world we live in now and what to do with that. And that there's obviously going to be incredible dissonance. You only have to look at DJ culture and the notion of aesthetic notion of sampling, which is, this is far advanced of the way poets are thinking about this in terms of appropriation, reappropriation, and putting things into creative and cognitive dissonance in order to produce, not in order to just demonstrate dissonance in and of itself, which would be sort of the most vulgar form of say paratoxics, just to sort of demonstrate these things clash and therefore transparency is revealed to be an ideological falsehood, etc. But that what new things come out of dissonance and carrying with them not a new unified whole, but all the chunks of the contextual chunks of the real, of all those fragments and of the dissonance itself, right? So, I spent something I feel particularly optimistic about or excited about, but I think it's this fate, at least the way I see things.
I just picked up the tail end of what you said. Maybe I'm not addressing
it. I was thinking what you said.
But that's, I think in the last, say, two years that my work is taking a turn toward, you know, having to use, you know, different languages and different scales, you know, different idioms and different levels and volumes and things of this sort to sort of bring out, you know, these contradictions in motion, you know, in a way that's not surrounding with, it has nothing to do with, see, I'm either like this, I'm either like, well, this is not me, and this is not me, you know, but like rather what, I feel sort of booed, like sort of bullied, yeah, by this, these sounds around me in New York specifically, yeah, but, Bob?
I don't know, listen, I'm speaking with no knowledge, just as a shell of the registration of the DJ culture, but it strikes me really strongly that there, the antagonism triumph is really the main mode. And there's a really well-developed audience, and everybody's hearing, and they're judging, and, you know, somebody sort of is better than others. And in poetry land, we have that kind of antagonism only between extreme tendencies, you know, formalism, etc. And just imagine, as a thought experiment, what it would be like to, scary thought, to import that kind of, well, you can't just import that antagonism without also importing the community that is like excited by the sport of that antagonism. But just imagine, you know, if one of you, you know, won last night, and that there was a big audience that, like, you know, cheered you on. I mean, there's, in some sense, there's community there, a very strong, articulated, highly attuned reception community to that kind of thing. Where there really isn't, I mean, here, you know, the receivers are the producers, as Borges says, and the issues of antagonism and judgment are pushed, you know, outside, and there's this magic circle of canary that everybody has been invoking for decades in individual circles. I don't have a
conclusion to that, but just the differences are so profound. Mm-hmm.
That's all.
So, Louis, I'm actually interested in, I don't know exactly what you want to say about sound, but to address potentially the problem of Rodrigo's audience not all knowing both of the, you know, all the lexicon references that any one of us might show up. I think that this is where history with the fragment and textuality as means of reception can be really powerful, because that doesn't necessarily have to be alienating us. And I wonder if you have any comments about, like, what were you going to say about sound? And does that have anything to do with as a means of not alienating audience and transmission?
Well, I don't think sound. No, I think you're right that. It's not the case that something that is opaque and that you don't get is threatening and alienating, a threatening and alienating experience. Yeah, I mean, I think it depends how it's inflected, and if there's a sense of sort of forward movement. That's so abstract in general. I don't know if you said, but this relationship of sound to, let's say, socially situated words next to sounds that would be liberated from sense is also just not a particularly new. I mean, of course, it's been done many times, but I think it's difficult to imagine now, I think, somewhat, given the vast, disparate types of, let's say, just talking about poetries out there, it's difficult to find, almost if you think of two transparencies, the moment when they're superimposed on each other and you're able to see both at the same time. I think, you know, that moment when you turn on the overhead projector and then these two transparencies are overlapping, and you get both sound that sense of liberation from sense, and also socially saturated sense matrix is kind of rare. It seems like there's some of us who are interested in purely formal, let's say, constraint-based work, liberated from any other any form of necessity that is outside of the purely set of formal necessities that are evoked in order to produce the work. And then the other end, and in another location, not necessarily a contrary or opposing one, you have people interested in, not in sound, not in constraint, not in form even, but in, let's say, let's say, take for example us, you know, interested in first figuring out the social and its the sense of it, of evoking it as a sort of generative matrix for thinking about perception and form. And but it seems like the occasions when those two, the formal and the social, sort of overlap, and you get both, are seen to be, and maybe it's just me, and you know, it's, this is my own very partial ability to absorb the new, what's out there, right? But it seems to me that it's rare, and today, and in some sense, I guess my hope was for us to attempt that sort of overlap here. But
I'd like to bring up just maybe as someone to discuss. Maybe it's a bad idea. I guess I'll find out. For example, some of the work, particularly the later, this very recent work that Emiri Barroca does, where he very much uses sound, not the transrational, if you want to call it, sound as signifying in his work. He breaks, for example, he'll break up pieces with, you know, music,
scatting,
zone, if you want to call it zone. But I think it's, it's very, even his sounds that aren't like lexical or whole words or even phonemes seem to carry a lot of meaning making.
They're marked, like Tom Toad, you know, like they've been like the theme song to sort of 60s and 70s shows that sort of act as a backdrop. They're extremely powerful, like, you know, dynamic context settings and, you know, adjustments of, you know.
Nonverbal like, signifying systems, whether they be tunes or, you know.
Or shift in accent, you know, just volubilities in accent within his own sort of like speech range, you know, where he would you know, not like imitated, not like what I did last night, imitating some Russian or some crap like that, but like actually within his own his own range, you know, of like which with what the kind of ways that you change your voice as you move through the world, if you do, and I think that if and that makes a lot of sense. For me, it makes a lot of sense. Across languages, because I grew up speaking two languages or whatever. So when I shift into a different language, the impulse to do that is not like I do this sort of bilingual poetry in Spanish and English, you know, like that. When I feel the impulse to shift, I shift, but not necessarily into my primary language. I just do a different idiom, and that's socially led, and now it's politically tactical for me to do that in the poetry, to sharpen a moment or something. I'm always concerned in you know, making language stick out in some way, not just sort of just flatten.
Well, one thing I'm going to throw across you from my debates with language poetry, or whether or not language poetry is non-referential, which I don't believe that it is, even though it's a standard critique, is that all sound is socially significant. So I don't know if, you know, even with our friends in Toronto, for instance, if we could just say that this sound is drained of social significance.
There's always
social significance too.
Yeah, I mean,
but there are, you know, what Laura's saying is that there's a way in which one can emphasize that or augment that or crank it up at some level. And that's sort of what David was doing. I mean, he was cranking it up for sure. There is the sound quality. And some people don't do that as much.
But I think that actually I heard a lot of it last night. So really, I'm glad that it's a question that you look at when you investigate, because I think that it is. Like, Jules, if I didn't know what a rock meant after you read that poem, I think I'd look it up. And if I didn't know that Jeff was reading a catalog of countries and the number of barrels that the U.S. imports, barrels of oil from those countries, I think that I would really be curious as to what this, you know, interspersed list was going through his poem. So I think that there is actually a lot that's happening with Sam that we can leverage, if not for investigation, but for meaning. So I think that it actually is happening. And yeah, I agree. I think that it's definitely a question worth investigating.
Yeah, Carol, I'm going to pick up right where you left off. But we talked a little bit this morning about how in Jeff's work, you know, those barrels or whatever, it was a sort of like a punctuated rhythm where you could get, you know, this political economic sort of infusion, you know, along sort of, you know, cultural spaces, but in motion, so you could get like the rhythm of content and not just sort of just context of some sort of static background where you just say, well, this is the story behind this poem, and then, you know, and then you just read it and you know, just this acts as contrast before as a sort of like live kind of thing.
Or if maybe Jules, you could talk about, because the thing that you seem to do a lot in your work is, one, I think there's a similarity with you and with Jeff, and maybe with David, and sometimes Rodrigo, in using, and Carol, and Kaya, using like a lot of factual information, yet one thing you seem to do is intersperse it with periods where you sort of stream a bunch of words together almost as an interruptive device or something like that. And then the use of like limericks between them. And,
I definitely think that a lot of people are doing somewhat similar things. This sort of like strings of words, you know, that I at least try to have them playing off each other as they kind of go along, kind of clicking off each other or blending into each other. I mean, that's sort of, I mean, following the impulse, like you're talking about when you're changing languages. I mean, there's a sort of similar dynamic going on there with that in my mind as I do it. But I also think that, yeah, I mean, if we're looking for commonalities, it's funny, you say one person, then you kind of start looking around, and you're like, wow, there was a lot of that going on last night. And it's kind of what I've been kind of over and over sort of saying, and I'm not sure if I'm satisfied with the phrase, but sort of like a concerted cobbling together of things to see what happens when you do cobble these things together from a variety of sources.
With me, it's like it even up to the point of making up, you know, words, you know, combining, you know, different parts of words to make like terms that don't exist, like. Like in one of the poems, you know, I was thinking of uneven development as, you know, being walloped. And so I wonder if you remember, omne wallop palescent divisidrarian. Or, you know, and then I say it again, omne wallop palescent. So it's okay for me to not use established critical. In fact, it's becoming more important for me to use non-established critical language in my poetry or to tweak it to make it both to stick out to the people who are familiar with it, and also to sort of spice it with the word that another part of an audience can understand what it is at the time when I say it in the gesture.
So you're avoiding totality in a way, like fostering community.
What's that?
It's kind of interesting. It sounds like you're avoiding totality as a means of fostering community, like a wider community, more porous.
Some sort of active engagement of that maybe.
But that might be an example of why like totality can be dangerous.
I don't know. You know, the totality thing, I'm going to avoid.
Well,
I'm
all the way around.
Yeah, I mean,
I know it's like a very mixed thing. The word totality makes people super nervous. Yeah. I just don't think we should play it off like that it shuts down all other options. I think capital imagines itself as totality. So I think it's useful to investigate and interrogate how how a totality might be constructed, which in the end you could reject, but I don't want to just in a sense reject it because it's bad and we can have another good model. Because I've actually not specifically arguing against what you were just presenting, but I've been in several cultural forums where people tend to fetishize a network system and then end up in a set of exclusions that you would think, well, that would only happen within a totality. But I've sat around in like forums like this where people give detailed talks on their method of organizing and anti-globalization organizing, and then at the end, almost like some vending machine where you pump some money and something will spit out, and the thing that gets spit out is like some other organization that they've decided not to work with because they're not networking enough. So they get excluded from the all-inclusive.
So you don't network with them, right?
Yeah, they get excluded from the all-inclusive network because they're not inclusive enough or something. Mm-hmm. So they get plunked out. Yeah. So it's just, for me, it's like how to think the network model versus the totality model in some kind of dialectic. And it's also to pose the effects of the totality and how do we counter them? With what do we counter? Maybe there's an idea of a tactical totality, maybe, which would be taking hegemony very seriously. Also taking the term the social. You know, taking the social very seriously in the sense of the social is the process into which society congeals, and then that's the hegemonic moment, and then that moment is pried loose through, you know, perhaps a countervailing weight of networking, or is very struck with something that you said, Kai, that this the kind of juxtapositions that is allowed through poetry, and then how that's allowing you to make social conjunctions. And what really strikes me in the way we've been talking, really, I find it really exciting in the last hour we've been talking, is that none of these devices, of course, are new. You know, and it's like we can situate them back in any particular century and find these kinds of devices, shapes and voices, registers, and that. But what I find so striking in the way people are talking about is the sense of a socially necessary device. And really, this strikes at the heart of your concerns as well, my friend, because how the social mark is embedded at the level of form. I think it comes, the sense I'm getting is coming from a sense of social necessity. The only sense of juxtaposition, for me, it's the sense of speed, and that's why I feel really optimistic about poetry as a model, not because it's outside of some kind of political economy that gives it a privileged position, but precisely because it's embedded within, and it's left alone a little bit more, in a sense, it doesn't have, although recently that changed, I guess, with the poetry at the White House, but also just as a form, it strikes, I think maybe it's an adequate form and a socially necessary form for addressing the crisis. If we feel like the crisis is not a slow building thing, but rather is kind of based on very speedy interchanges. Somehow it feels to me that poetry can be that countervailing weight of that.
Isn't
it still? Perhaps. No, so I said last night, what part of my unmanned area? What part of Kiss My Unmanned Aerial Drone don't you want to
see? As long as we're always defining poetry in terms of its places in which it's received, institutions that support it, it's important to keep that part of the equation.
Right. But I think we also have to balance the point of production as well. I mean, that's part of the semantic work of Marx, I think, is the emphasis on the point of production. And, of course, we can. We all know how work is received, and we factor that in and try and structure in things that are pointed and things that are open at the same time, which I think is a real strong point of all the work that we heard last night. But also, I think we have to think of what the determinants are at the point of production. I take that as being a really incredibly valuable point from the Frankfurt School. That's really a point.
What does that mean? You mean like new writing?
I think it means both. I mean, it means both the determining instance in Marxian theory, production in Marxian theory, but at the same time, aren't you also suggesting that the determining point of production is such a gathering as this? Which if that's the case, then let me just, I don't know if I can do this, but I just want to do two things quickly, and maybe Alan, I'd be interested to know what you think of this use of invoking a totality, but let me just, in the spirit of reusing upholstered, rhetorically festering terms from the past, or declaring that there's nothing in some sense new here, that what we're trying to do is reinvent the basic toolkit. To open the toolkit of poetry once again and look at these various tools that we have available to us, like sound, etc., that others have used, so we're not sort of reinventing the hammer or the sickle or the little squeegee sound block, the sound thing. But so, for example, here is Mayakovsky and Brick, who invented the notion of social command. He used the term social necessity. And so it's translated, I don't, of course, speak Russian, but this is from 1926. He gives this definition of what this term they invented called social command. And okay, this is very generic language. It could apply to almost anything. It's almost, in that sense, perhaps unidimensional. But nevertheless, their definition is the presence of a problem in society, the solution of which is conceivable only in poetical terms. So that's the social command. So that sense that allows for contradiction, overdetermination, but it also allows for a level of sort of like consciousness raising around what the problem is in this thing that might not exist that is called society, because it's, you know, to use the word society is to invoke in some sense a whole.
That's what Margaret Thatcher said after this. There is no such thing as society.
But getting back to the thinking of the determining point of production in the sense, in the everyday sense of you, the writer with the pen, you're the determining point of production, or it's us here uttering some words over a weekend. And so thinking about that in relation to how things have changed now from, let's say, some time ago. I'd say a couple of decades ago.
Oh, so specific.
Okay, a couple of decades ago. I'm thinking of Laura's. I apologize in advance because it's going to be messy and strung out, but I'm hoping it'll cohere. But Laura, one of the texts that you suggested that we read and that has been available online for downloading is this one, which basically the gist of it is that the economy and the cultural have sort of like fused together, and it's what is being elided is the social or the political. And you give examples of a non-profit art gallery space is sort of privately funded, so completely sort of like eliding that the opposition between public and private, you know. No longer that duality no longer sort of applies. I mean, a couple of decades ago, there was such a thing as an alternative economy. You know, you could get a part-time job, you could live in the same sort of neighborhood, or you could coalesce in the same neighborhood, and you could spend some time doing something other than the necessary putting in clocking time to make enough money to live on. You had a part-time job. I'm sort of idealizing perhaps, but I think it's nevertheless the case that in the beginning in the 1980s, the idea of an alternative economy sort of dried out. It's no longer possible to imagine an alternative economy. I'm generalizing here, I know.
I think there are tons of alternative economies. Any inner city neighborhood is fundamentally based on an alternative economy.
Yeah, I know. I mean, West Philly here is.
So are rural communities. Pardon you? So are rural communities.
Right, but I'm talking about, let's say, writers.
In
writers, like the point, you know, the point, if you think of that phrase that Jeff used, point of, the determining point of production, think of ourselves, okay? We don't live in the same neighborhood. We have very different types of work. We have to artificially create a sense of collective point of production by gathering here today. When I think a few decades ago, it could have been likely that instead of doing something like this, we might have lived in the same, we might have ended up in the same Nudist cat,
for instance.
Same way?
Nudist cat.
Nudist cat, yes. Yes, and that speaks, I think, to the way that the term network is used in this article that maybe Lori helped me recall, but where their companies are very interested in hiring these sort of innovative group stools of people who are thinking about creating new products or whatever, so that in some sense there's a kind of is what we're doing any different from one of these networks that you refer to of software innovators who are eventually sort of absorbed into the product and company product.
Okay, so I think first, I don't know if I'm...
I'm sorry, that was so...
Okay, so I was thinking about, let me just explain, for example, one of the diagrams on here. That basically this article is about the City of London, and what it's looking at is the way that cultural institutions have changed over the last, say, 20 years. And something that has happened, instead of having an actual space where artists come together and cobble out a project, who meet regularly, say, in somebody's living room or at a school, that instead of that, there's this new sort of space, which is an abstract space that is created through a networking of organizations. And the guy starts I can't find it, but there's this quote that basically he says, you know, the corporation is no longer an actual physical space. It's bodily relations that people sort of carry around with them, or not like relationships that they don't have an actual embodiment anymore. And so it becomes a kind of unseen totality in that way. So, like, for example, you might have I'm just talking about art, cultural production. So there would be like maybe a government-funded institution such as a museum, and a corporation who wants to co-sponsor some kind of event. Maybe it's just for publicity. Maybe they actually want a product out of it. Then there's an artist-run space, and they call it a network venture zone. And what it is a cyberspace where these people meet and contacts are made and projects get funded somehow and whatnot. So I was interested in that. One, because of that idea that of then the work getting done somewhere that's not a somewhere, that it's purely a concept-driven affair, which obviously is, as Louis said, it collapses the cultural into the economic. So that, in other words, what the article is talking about is this idea of marketing a city, actually marketing London, how a city, how an urban center becomes an urban center. How does New York, sort of maintain its economic, financial center of the Western Hemisphere? Well, first, it makes the city a desirable place for companies to locate. How does it do that? Well, it needs culture. And so this is one of the ways that London, and it was a concerted policy-driven effort on the collaboration between corporations and government agencies.
Yeah, so I just, I know, yeah, sure, but you know, so in other words, the network venture zone is, you know, obviously, you know, capital here in the literal sense, and the values are significantly, let's say, different from those that one might associate with the network venture zone of the kind that Laura is describing, but nevertheless, as a model of social logic, it seems to be part of the same scape. So, in terms of going back to the idea of the social command, and I just wonder.
Well, can I think of a couple of things that I just all of your ideas in my head? One example I can think of this sort of economic cultural lapse, which always ends up aiding the economics in some way. So, but is like the Xerox PARC, where they hire these artists over many years. They hired artists largely to refine how to or advance their own technology, like how the mouse can be a better tool for enabling someone to do word processing or something like that. So, I mean, all that was still funneled towards this one, this other, these economic games, but. Something Bob said that is still haunting me. And you said this early on. He said, well, sometimes you guys were picking up these words like porous, and we're not really, like, in other contexts, that's a catastrophe right there, where, like, I can think of an example of sort of how these words are going around, like, there's, like, for example, Deleuze's valorization of this nomad idea. And then, so, Agamben comes in and says, well, wait a second, that's in another context, that's the refugee. And the whole plight, I mean, you think you freed the nomad, but in fact, all over the world, there's this constant refugee problem being recreated in these different spaces. And that's the real term to go out from, and that's the clue right there. And then I'm thinking of terms like the network. That sounds to me like, in another context, that's the valorized term in the
dominant. Did you say that?
Well, yeah. the network.
I mean, the bad way. To be the Patriot Act, called surveillance.
Yeah. Or even this idea of the social. I mean, for us, I guess somehow in our minds, maybe it resonates with socialists and something. That's sort of this mark of, well, the fullness of the social would be a socialist kind of version versus sort of there's that second sort of socializing. Well, that's sometimes I wonder, why is the social command buzzing in my head as this kind of socializing process? And I'm wondering, how do I get away from that in some way? I don't know. So I'm just trying to. I like how these individual words are pushed at stake. I mean, especially the word network. It seems to me that's like the dominant mode of how capitalism organizes itself right now. And yet, that's also the mode of how many of these activist groups organize themselves too. And who's going to get that term in the end? Or are they just kind of mimicking each other somehow? I don't know. I mean.
So in other words, it's not inherent to the form, like. The network is, to keep going back to this idea of a cultural logic or a social logic. I mean, it's there, so it's not that necessarily the form is God in and of itself.
And I wonder, too, if Jeff's assertion that the WTO has asserted that, has decided that totality is a good thing, so maybe we need to fight fire with fire. And maybe that's why, like, the network model is something that we can really learn a lot from. And I'm also starting to wonder if the network and totality, and I'd like to hear more of how you're thinking about it, because I think maybe that's not clear enough to exist like this. But they might not be mutually exclusive.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's dialectic. But I mean, the problem with totality is it carries such a heavy historical weight, and then it's like everything will be clamped down under it, so.
But we could be for a totality of redistribution of wealth. I mean, that's a totality. Yeah,
that's what I was going to say. For me, it's like, earlier I was talking about, like, what's the point on the horizon towards which some goal would be. And perhaps it is that when the network hits the goal, it would become a totality. In a sense, it's just that we have to redefine the goal towards it.
Here I would add a little bit of an adjustment on this thing where we're talking about point of production, as a sort of metaphor. I think it's really important to be fairly literal about the point of production. For example, somebody in upstate New York who owns a second home, chopping wood all day long, building a little thing, that's not to me like a point of production. Me sitting after hours where I work at the Labor Institute working on a poem is not a point of production. I think it's The thing about a point of production is important because it defines, like, what is not a point of production, what is a point of distribution, where does culture begin outside of the the point of production, of course, the point of production is also a culture, and a culture needs to change and transform. But if you're talking about this totality of, you know, transforming or taking over the means of production and all this business as a sort of horizon, you know, I'm thinking about that sort of liberatory project, if you will, and then this thing you're talking about, that, you know, this network stuff, is Hakim Bey talks about this stuff about temporary autonomous zones. I don't know if you heard about that. He really pushes, you know, this is the importance of the temporary autonomous zones to build this networking. And it's curiously way outside of the point of production. Eric Klutenberg, a German critic, art critic who I don't know much about, but I knew that he sort of put Hakim Bey's term, and he started calling them temporary entertainment zones. Is that where we want our sort of poetry to be, temporary entertainment zone? I mean, sort of. And this just brings up Marx's sort of like emphasis on the point of production at the level of, you know, to many it might sound antiquated, but the level of the shop floor, the level of production. But it's a very important site if you're talking about an emancipatory, you know, politics down the line. I mean, I'm just offering this as a sort of.
So where is platform produced? Where's the point production? Not you writing.
No. See, I would support the notion of an aligned political, social, political practice. And so, like, I align myself with those forces that can act as a counter-hegemonic, counterbalances against capital. And for me, that would be, I would defend the category of the working class as a category counterbalance of capital, like, or labor and capital. I mean, maybe not here, but I would make that argument, or I think that argument is in motion, and I can add to that. And so, where is, you mean, talking about like my book platform?
Where's the point of production? You said it wasn't you writing, you said it was great. So I'm just curious. Where's, could you define a point of production, or points of production?
Well, okay. Well, specifically for me, like in my job, I work at a sort of a think tank within organized labor. That thing is funded, and this is, I'm going to go along with this for now. I think it's an interesting question, because I don't know, as I'm speaking, I don't know where this is going to end up. But, and the Labor Institute is funded largely by PACE, which is Paper Allied Industrial Chemical Energy Workers Union, the oil, atomic, all this kind of stuff. And so that's a specific sector of the capitalist economy. And so can we also think about poetries as being sort of nominally representative of particular sectors of the capitalist economy? I would be okay, like if Carol actually does a lot of stuff in media work and the internet stuff, and she, when a lot of the work that she does in sort of resistance, she doesn't like talk about chopping, you know, wheat, you know, by hand in Bangladesh. She talks about the struggles within her particular sector. And so that's the way that I would begin to think about that. In academia, you would attack on the level of ideas mainly, and also specific work conditions. Yeah, all combined in a curious way, in sort of marked up language way.
So you're saying that the point of production for a cultural, for poetry is actually really literal.
No, it would differ, and this is one of the things that what I'm hearing people differently. Like Jeff has been all over the globe, you know, like this last 2 years. And if you ask him the question, like, where's the point of production of your poetry? It would be
sector.
Okay, but he gets funding from the Canadian government. The Canadian government has been able to do these grants. Why? Because of social provision, and it's been an accumulation, and it's a social, it's a right. Sort of rights granted by the social democratic state at a particular time. Now, why did that happen? Because certain movements, you know, when and where is the ultimate point of production for somebody's poetic practice? It's lots of times, you know, you don't know. I think or it's lost, but we can guess, right? If we're materialists.
So you're evoking not a totality, but a some kind of collectivity, some sort of temporary or long-standing or complex changing social historical body, and the poem is like the tongue, you know, the expression of that particular social body?
In part, yeah.
And so how do you belong to, you know, one body to communicate with another body?
Well, first of all, in my work, I do talk about that. I talk about you know, not just labor at the point of production, you know, like widgets, you know, going off the line, but from widgets to, you know, the cultural scaffolding that goes to, you know, the ideological scaffolding that supports the understanding of that labor in the field of ideology, in the field of literature, in the field of things like Marx partly is interesting to me too, because he's attacking the erasure of a lot of things, you know, with points of production and things like that. I don't know if I answered your question.
I wonder, has Foucault so fallen out of favor that we can't even use the word discourse? You were talking earlier, you know, when you write art criticism, you put a red line through ideology. I mean, it seems quite obvious that, you know, everyone that's room almost is, you know, this poetry. I mean, we may talk about it as a kind of political alliance building, cultural border crossing, but, you know, when I listened to the poetry last night, I hear a lot of discourses that people are trying to make self-conscious in a certain way. So, you know, when I think of point of production, you know, I'm definitely thinking of, you know, a kind of poetry that's informed by, you know, various discourses and how they interrelate, how they don't interrelate, how they're made, how they're foregrounded, and how they're hidden behind, and, you know, and then, of course, the institutional structures that support those discourses. And I think we have to be honest with ourselves that there's only a certain amount of liberation that occurs from the poem on the page, and that it's the larger discourses and institutions, and then maybe, if we're really lucky, the economic engines that we're dealing with at some level.
That was my point, actually, about point of production is not so much the literal.
Yeah, I do
like get an axe and chop my poems up pieces. It's a long time, many injuries. But no, it was more about the determinants on the production.
Yeah.
Because so often we thought about the determinants of reception, which I think you've done a good job of understanding in some ways.
Yeah, we don't want to make the writer any more free than we not make the audience.
And to me, it also helps sharpen what that social necessity might be. It's like, you know, what are the determinants on the production? Because we understand determinants on reception, what's the determinants on production that's going to therefore sharpen what you do? It's like, and it can even be deflected. It's like, you know, just the basic research I was doing after September 11th and trying to figure out a way to live in, you know, the hardened national boundaries and national identity of the United States at a particular moment when globalization theory told us there was, you know, fluid boundaries. And so obviously they were hardened at almost every level of the scale, particularly the national and the ethnic body. So just a little bit of basic research, and you find out that, let's see, since I forget now, 2.3, pardon my dyslexia, but 3.2 minutes of news per day in the global city at that level line. So it's like the major news networks, let's say 3.2 minutes of international news. And so that, to me, that's a determinant on information that shuts down in a certain way. And then so, you know, I've actually felt more compelled to include information at a certain, I'll say, scale, a certain kind of international, transnational scale within the work. So like whether it's listening at the amount of oil barrels that are imported into America. But I felt that impulse because I see that as a determinant on information that's coming at another point of production. And so how that then informs what the cultural might do. Not that the cultural is like this thing that's, you know, a free, liberatory, liminal space, you know, but to recognize the specific sets of determinants and to recognize how quickly they change. It's like unbelievably quickly that they change. I mean, you know, Lytle Shaw and Emily Clark get arrested for taking essentially family snapshots of people who happen to live in Baghdad, but, you know, people who were snapping up big big posters of the JC CD, which is selling the product, don't get arrested for essentially doing anything that is equally as illegal. So suddenly there's a clampdown on the kinds of information. And again, the speed of poetry makes me excited for it as a social form. Because you know, as things rapidly get shut down, what's going to be the reaction to it? So, and then that cuts against two ideas of timeless literature, more like timely literature.
But there are discourses that inform the way that you are then presenting your material. Like, there may be people in the audience not saying, you know, you're talking about Barrels of Oil.
So they do say Barrels of Oil.
You do. At the end, you know, if you miss that one line or, you know, or something.
Yeah, but I have some poems where I have a listing of nations without. And then I don't have the explanation.
Uh-huh.
And then people have come up to me after and said, yeah, Russia 3.2. And then say, yeah, because when it's Russia at the top and Sweden at the bottom of this one list, and people construct their own thing. There's a way of constructing a logic.
And the one you had, wasn't the currency exchange rate between the Canada and the US and was tracking that.
Right.
Again, it has that sort of like rhythm or punctuation form.
So I try to have it work on. You know, I guess it's very influenced by structural linguistics in a material way. Like, how do I understand the material that I'm working with? And so the idea of like having language work on several levels at the same time, where, so for instance, the emphasis on sound, or let's say a socially necessary use of sound in a particular way at a particular moment, you know, it's also therefore semantic at the same time. So like working on the different levels of language simultaneously. So at one point someone might not get the semantic gaffled
Lufa.
Lithuanian Air Force.
What's that? Lufa? Is that the Lithuanian Air Force?
I don't know.
but they can get the phonetic, you know. Lufa's very kind of a local phonetic nugget.
That too, yeah. Even closer.
But see, there's the poor specific, you know. So you can't have it both ways, diesel, you know, of having various people associate various things with unfamiliar words and terms. That's good for us somehow. But on the other hand, the kind of double audience that Rodriguez is speaking and addressing, that doesn't work. It just sort of evoke a kind of free association. To give a non-union audience enough of the beginning of an education, what's at stake.
Definitely.
You can't just logic doesn't work for you. And just what he just said doesn't work for what you just seem
that's
to
why mean. They're on opposing sides.
I mean, sir, in the middle, I beg to differ.
I don't understand what you're saying.
That sometimes you don't explain the numbers. And that people have all sorts of associations with that. Well, okay, gaffle.
Well, look. That was an instance in a particular piece where I, you know, very sort of in a sort of schmaltzy way, to me, uneven development. You know, I make it very, very plain that it's like a four-page poem, and just in two instances, to consider the terms. That maybe one goes to one audience and one goes to the other. That's not sort of some, I'm not looking for sort of an imminent methodology where that's going on all the time. That's not like the, you know, the keel of what I do and, you know, or whatever.
Earlier you sort of said it was. Not to heroicize yourself.
Well, just read my work. I mean, I don't do the same thing every time, you know?
Right.
I don't want to.
I think there's a way in which you got to be careful that you're just. You're reinscribing certain discourses. You're not necessarily opening the poem up to any possible reader or two sets of readers. I mean, when you inscribe certain language and certain discourse, then you know you're directing the reading to a degree. You're determining the text to a certain degree. You don't have the freedom of like, oh, this audience is going to get this half of it, and this audience is going to get this half of it.
Well,
it doesn't work that way.
I'm not suggesting that's the case, but I'm suggesting. That there's people in the audience, including embodied in a singular member, that might be that split audience itself.
This is
what about an intellectual, non-academic worker? That's me. You know, I'm not an academic, so like here it is. This contradiction is embodied in what you know, the fuzzy outlines of what this is. Right?
Yeah, I'm not trying. I think my tolerance value. I mean, I'm not trying to be a harsh critic. It's just the inertial difficulties of these problems. That's what I'm trying to get at. That's all.
I'm not anti-ambiguity. I'm sorry.
I feel like I've been dropped in the middle. I mean, obviously, I'm dropped in the middle of the discussion. And I was trying to work up the sides we're representing somehow, if there were sides. Okay, but I suppose that the word porous, I don't know if it's something you constructed as you just were speaking or something you were discussing at all, but I mean, for me, porous represents something that leads both ways. It's not just something that runs through one way. And you didn't use, you used porous rather than transparent, rather than, so using porous suggests to me something that takes, depends how thick the material is, how porous it is, and what goes through is not, you can't direct it, you can't sort of, it's not like it sort of holds with it from a sieve where you can say, well, that thing's going to run through in that way. So porous seems something that's very, is going to be bleeding somehow, and it's going to sort of impact both ways. And I think I sort of heard people saying about this, the poet also being part of a process. I suppose I was nervous that it seemed a bit like this education that goes in one direction, rather than saying that the poet is actually living the society within she's writing from, and she's not sort of a class who sort of takes a role of saying, well, here I am, and I've looked at these words for you, which could be the role of the poet, which is to say, I'm recording those things that are part of society, so here's my record, because society is constructed in a way that you can actually get the record. Mm-hmm. So I'm sort of interested, when you say porous, it's not just about somehow a transmission effect, it's more sort of like something that's, you sort of said it, how is it controlled somehow, because it's not... It can't be controlled. It's porous. It's sort of like it just seeps. And if you're if you are the audience yourself, I mean, I can't see how the speaker is not also fractured somehow. It's not. How can the speaker be so sort of unified to know? Okay, I've got this message. Because I can speak as someone who is, the thinker who's sure about this idea, but also someone who's not sure about why I'm standing in the first place saying this stuff, or why I should be standing in this. So it doesn't feel.
Well,
you still used it. I'm just wondering why.
Yeah, I'm not an educator. I don't even think about poetry as necessarily translation.
Yeah.
I guess the reason I thought of porous, I thought of it first as the antithesis of something that's impenetrable.
Yeah.
And the reason that I think of it is because porous is material, but it also allows for, it also has room for integration. And so, when I think of myself as a poet, I think of myself as a cultural being, a cultural entity who very much desires merging with other cultural entities and beings. And so that's why I mostly thought of it as something that's not perpetual. But I didn't think of it as something that was unilateral at all.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this idea of porous and then Rodrigo's idea of the sign as, whether... Maybe we can drop the word for the thing. The idea that a sign, like a word, and Alan, your thing about discourse, I mean, a word can be porous. In other words, a word can be multi-accentual, right? And in that sense, like the word, many words this is not my language, so signs that are struggled over. So, I'm trying to think of an example. There's numerous ones, but like, and you, one of in your poems, for example, you have that poem about Quetzalcoatl lands on Caragon. It's a spoof. But what you're saying is, if you plot the term, Burma in the middle of your poem, it's definitely things are going to shift. And then in terms of the discourses, the idea of releasing someone at something and it's going that way and it's one, it's this discourse, that I feel like everything, especially in most of our work, is shot through in a lot of ways. And so maybe one of the things is trying to show how these terms, these uses of language are part of a larger struggle. I don't know if that's making sense, but that a term itself is porous and going many.
We could maybe scale down the global body to the sign, which I mean, Polo Sina says that, you know, the sign is the site of ideological struggle in the classroom,
specifically classroom.
And then so, you know, when you were thinking what term could I, just when you paused for a moment, what term it was you could use, you know, like Arab American, for instance, becomes a site of immense struggle, like overnight, literally. So how that shows like how the sign is ideological and how it's really can shift quickly as a sign of ideological struggle. Amazing. So whether it's, you know, so this is the idea, you know, that's if that's a porous sign, then something gets in and hardens it in a sense. And then
but that's not part of the sign, it's part of the perception of this, that particular sign. And that's not a but as in disagreeing, rather it's not that I don't mind disagreeing, but I just mean in addition, I mean it's the porousness, if it's a social porousness, and that's actually how, for example, Solomon talks about the social in that blog post that combined, and that's how you get that sort of palimpsest effect of sound and socially situated, socially situated meanings, connotations, affixing themselves to words. And it's a question of how can you produce that perception as part of your work? It's a collective type of activity, establishing that kind of like horizon of meanings for words. I'm just wondering though that we've been going for a while. I just wanted to let you know that it's 5:30, and we had promised to finish at 5 and start at 3, neither of which we did. So I'm just thinking, you know, I don't want to shut things down, but on the other hand, I want to say that, you know, we're pretty tired of thinking. It's over, and you know, maybe just like 5 more minutes. If there's anything anyone wants to say, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 more minutes, we can let one. If there's anything anyone wants to say to sort of close up.
I just think like a follow up on Deborah's comment. Maybe she wants to follow up on this, but yeah. My sense, and to get back to the point of production, 50% of production is perception. And because you can't guess what your audience is, or you can't even.
But you can write it into your work.
That's my point. You may write it into your work more than you realize. That's what I'm saying. There's this is also contrary to, you know, the active reader theory that you know, it's just a really great meaning making sharing experience. But that's to deny all of the kind of discourses that go into both the production of it and the reception of it. And for better or for worse, you know, those, as Foucault tells us, are discourses of power, and we're much more complicit in them than I think we're sometimes willing to admit. One strategy, I think, in a lot of people's work is to make those stand out, you know, is to shine a light on it, say this is a discourse that I'm aware of, do with it what you want. Whether it's a class discourse or a cultural discourse, and I'm just trying to follow up a little bit. And, you know, it's my own thinking about audience as much as it is about production and how things are received. And, you know, we really need to get away from this vacuum of a reader coming for a text, an experimental text, and making whatever meaning of it they want, even if it's based on social background. I don't think the process is quite that free from the production or the reception end.
That's why I have to get this emphasize my previous emphasis, which was, I think in a way, for me, it sharpens the cultural, social cultural project to understand those determinants. Mm-hmm. But at both
again, I think everyone's working through last, you know, we saw it last night, it's always foregrounded in the work. It's always foregrounded.
And also I think there's a kind of optimism in not totalizing, maybe this is a bad one, not the bad totality, not totalizing an audience. So it's like as if there's only one social register that an audience is going to get, which, because it's so fun speaking for Mark, I think it's also, I think, part of Mark's project is to, you know, not to totalize the audience. And then, of course, because everybody, you know, you can feel there's times when you're just in whatever position you're in, and you want to react against that totalizing effect. That, you know, now that I'm Dr. Jeff, you know, people as it think that that's the only register that I can receive things in, whereas actually, you know,
we're producing things in.
Yeah, right.
You're expected to write.
Whereas, I mean, we can all think of different, not to fetishize a hybridity, but certainly to understand that it's not as homogenous or totalized as we want to think. So I thought that was part of what you were reacting to, is like a totalized audience, and then we can step in with our, I like this German term, besser wieser, like know better, kind of, and give people the info that they themselves, their goofy little selves, can't get.
Yeah, I suppose what I also responded to is that because I teach a poetry workshop, and people really are just doing it, because some of them do it because it's sort of an easy option, or you just write up poems that long, so then you can get through this course easily. So what tends to happen is people that I teach, some of them tend to sort of see that poetry is about them not getting it. So even if they got the poem, it's like, well, it's a poem, they're not supposed to take it literally, they're not supposed to understand it. That's the whole point of being a poem. And it's sort of like there's something in that sort of argument that, but you said they're very critical readers in other forms, but as soon as they enter a text, and even if it's a text, you say, look, let's read it together, they can read it, but it's almost like I've already got that expectation built in. Within a poetry workshop, that's not even like just anywhere else, but they're saying, I'm not supposed to get it, and it's not about me getting it, it's about this poet trying to be clever, this poet trying to be better, this poet trying to do. And I know this is an American experience more than anywhere else, or it's just like that's the way people are sort of being told that they cannot read these texts, which has a bit more of a sort of maybe a nuance or a stance, or something that's not just like this sort of almost up to the front, or sort of, you know, this approach that says like it's the immediacy of like you see something on TV and you're sort of like, okay, I get what they're saying, or I see this thing, I get what the message is. The poems that what's the message? This is all like the discourse that I'm sort of engaged in, and it's very frustrating in some ways because I'm doing people who don't even want to engage unless I'm sort of really work very hard to get that. And I'm saying that I shouldn't do it, I'm saying it's just sort of, I'm also part of that reader. Because I would be somewhere like that as well, and you know, and so I'm just finding I'm involved in that discussion of sort of being a poet and saying I love the way that you can see language and use it as a powerful tool to actually say what you mean, or not say what you mean, but still use it with sort of some sort of knowledge. But most people are seem to say, I don't want to use that language. I just want to be able to say, give me the money. Thank you. You know, like functional, it's still as though they've been, it's functional language, functional.
So, like, poem is deserved, you don't have to think, it's beyond, and if you're saying, no, you know, the trend won't work out.
I just want the bicycle.
So it's
taking something away from me that I really like, not thinking.
And again, I'm not trying to get to judgment of people's responses, but it's still the book is a struggle. That's what I'm saying. Sometimes it's hard to sort of bridge that sort of audience as well. You know, I'd rather not think of my work being accessible. It's not sometimes.
But a shout out to Louis and Aaron for convening and coming.
Thank you.